Black Friday, wow, shop, Wayfair now, month long big deals, yeah, these are steals.
70% less money spent.
You can't go wrong, check out the song. Festive decor, Black Friday scores,
garlands and trees,
saving with ease.
Lights for your house, lamps for your spouse,
save at Wayfair.
On dining chairs, mattresses, two sheets that are you. Everything home, these things in chrome. Here's a quick plug, area rugs, fast shipping, wow, Wayfair is how.
Win the season, win the, win the season.
Welcome, everybody, to Solo Spotlight, a show where we go beyond the sound bites and have real conversations with the people shaping our communities. I'm your host, Ryan McDougall, and today I'm joined by someone who's been at the heart of city building in Edmonton for over a decade, former city councillor and now 2025 mayoral candidate, Andrew Knack. Andrew has spent 12 years representing Edmonton's West End of city council, pushing for better transit, smarter urban planning, and community-focused policy. He's now stepping up for the run for mayor, and today we're diving deep into why he got into politics in the first place, what he's learned on council, and what he plans to do if he gets elected for mayor. The conversation is casual, thoughtful, and designed to give Edmontonians a chance to hear directly from the candidate himself. So whether you're curious, skeptical, or all in, this is the episode for you. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is awesome. Getting to interview people in politics is honestly been very, very educational, and I always am super grateful of being able to share the room with people that are shaping our city, are making choices at a higher level, and kind of have these minds for serving the community and having greater impact. How you feeling today? Good? We're busy today?
Every day is so very hectic now. It's very busy, but it's honestly inspiring to get to go across the city and meet new people and engage on different issues. So
yeah,
as exhausting as it is, it's also so exhilarating.
Yeah, I could only imagine. And you have done everything in order to get community engagement, and it's creative as well as like just inspiring. But I want to start off by talking about where this all began. You kind of got into politics at a very early age. I believe you ran at 23. You graduated with a Bachelor of Commerce. You started working at West Edmonton Mall, very far away from kind of politics. Kind of talk to me about that. What actually drove you into politics and running in 2013?
So much. Well, I think back to when I was growing up. So my parents were very engaged politically, and they never ran or anything like that, but they were always involved volunteering on campaigns and really trying to reinforce the importance of being politically active. So much so that like when I was a kid growing up, we would stay up late in front of the TV on election night. The same way you'd gather in front of the TV for the Stanley Cup finals or the mm-hmm. Super Bowl, we could do that for election night. So I was allowed to stay up late. And so early on, it was ingrained in me why voting is important, why politics is important. But I actually never thought I would run. I fake it really well now. I am still a massive introvert. And so this is a very weird job to be in as a massive introvert. Mm-hmm. But it was in 2007, when I was 23, I just graduated. I was thinking about that election because, as mentioned, I follow politics very closely, never thought I'd run. And I was thinking about who I was going to vote for, and I wasn't feeling as inspired as I could. And at the same time, I also wanted to see younger voices represented. For the longest time, if you go look at the history of all the people who've been in city council, it was very, very rare to see younger voices. And so I remember looking it up, and I found out, all you need to run is 25 signatures and $100. Mm-hmm. That's all you need to do to get your name on the ballot. And I realized what's the worst case scenario? If I'm really not feeling inspired and I want to be inspired and want to see younger people involved, well, the worst thing that would happen is I get one vote. And is that really so bad? I mean, maybe it's a little bit humiliating if you only get one vote, but if that was really the worst case scenario, why not try? And so I did. I lost horribly. I got better than one vote, but not much better. But it was through that experience of actually knocking on doors, engaging with people, that I woke up the next morning and my life had shifted. I thought I was going to be in business. That was what I went to school for. That's what all my family had been in, their own small businesses. But I woke up the next morning and I realized I wanted to focus more of my life on public service. And so ran again in 2010, lost again, but had a much better finish. And then sort of went all in 2013. I actually, you know, I was managing the retail business in West Edmonton Mall. I quit my job 4 months before the 2013 election. I went all in, just knocking on doors, and was fortunate to get elected to serve at the age of 29 in 2013.
Was local government always where you were targeting? Because I'm not sure if that's like a natural progression of, like, you see former Mayor Sohi, he was trying to go for, I think it was provincial or...
Federal,
right. Kind of talk me through that. What was this always something you wanted to do, or is there... kind of, is this like natural steps of like you do city councilor, then you try for mayor, then you go and then you move up, or is this kind of always where you wanted to land?
So it's funny because a lot of the politics that I used to follow was more provincial and federal. I didn't follow municipal as closely. And I was remembering that thought process in 2007, thinking about the election. And part of what drove me to local politics, and in hindsight, it's going to feel a little silly to say now, but I felt that at the time, almost 20 years ago, when I was 23, that the federal and provincial system was not for me because I felt that it was too partisan, that it was too polarizing. Goodness, little did we know
right.
The system has become even more polarized, and I would long for the polarization of 2007. But part of what I thought about is that at the end of the day, I wanted to be somebody that could... truly keep an open mind when I went into a decision, because, you know, in the partisan system, you have to really do what the party tells you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, you can try to sway them behind the scenes, but if the party has made a decision and it's not the decision you wanted to see, you're still got to follow it. And municipally, you don't have to. It is truly nonpartisan, although this is the first local election where we will have political parties, but many of us are running as independents, including myself. But it was through that, just wanting to have a system where you could still hear different perspectives, where you could genuinely listen and understand. And even if at the end of the day, we didn't agree with one another, we could hopefully have a respect about why we each felt the way that we did. And then maybe we could still pull from each other and make better decisions as we go forward.
Right. And it's interesting too, because I always tell people that I work with, and from gaining all of this knowledge from interviewing different candidates and different people in whether it's civic policing or, you know, any different type of candidate, it always strikes me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I always try to tell people that if you're looking for major change, like municipal elections is going to be the closest and the most feeling that you're going to feel, based on if you're a house owner, if you're a renter, if you bike, if you don't bike, like this is what's going to impact like your immediate life. And then the bubble gets bigger and bigger when you move out, where it's like, okay, GST and this and that and different laws. But in terms of like day-to-day feel, this is kind of as close as it gets.
Absolutely. And that's why it's always so odd that the municipal voter turnout is as low as it is, because you think about all of the municipal services that you interact with on a daily basis, the roadway system, sidewalks, transit, police stations, fire halls, recreation centers, libraries, parks. I mean, these are all the things that you experience every day. You know, if you go up that next quote unquote level to provincial, sure, you might have, depending on your situation, family in the education system, which is provincial, or in the healthcare system. But again, you're starting to get more removed. And yet, when you go provincially, you go federally, you see the voter turnout increase substantially more when the issues that we're dealing with municipally are the ones that truly impact every aspect of your daily life. And so, you know, it's important to have conversations like this. It's important to try to reach out to people in as many different ways so they hopefully consider that, because, yeah, there are still doors I'm going to that people are saying, oh, there's an election coming up, and they don't realize, even today, 3 days away at the time of recording this, that people are saying, oh, there's an election coming up. And you just want to say,
yeah,
how did you miss this?
Yeah.
Like, this is a big deal. Something's going on that has a massive impact on your life. But So it's just a matter of continuing to repeat the message, reach as many people as they can, as we can, to say, these are the issues that really will impact your quality of life. Whether you choose to stay in this city is based off what we do at City Council every day.
What do you think the root of that problem stems from? Do you think it's a publication thing? Do you think it's an education that people don't really know what's going on in municipal government, or that it just isn't worth it? Because you have a lot of people too that, from what I've been hearing, they don't choose who to vote for till the day of the election. So is that an education thing, or is it that there's not enough airtime?
Yeah, I think it's a combination, and you're right. I mean, I remember the 2013 election when I finally did get elected, and I looked at my website traffic, and the most website traffic was, and by a large margin, was the day of election.
Mm-hmm.
Even the weekend before, while it was high, it was nothing compared to what happened on day of. And so I think there's a few challenges. Municipal politics, and when I first started, local media was a lot stronger. They had a lot more people covering. There used to be, it was very commonplace to see 6 or 7 reporters working in City Hall all day long. So they were there watching the entire council meeting, covering everything. Now we're lucky if we get one reporter covering the entire day. And most of the time what happens is that they just show up at lunchtime to do an interview with the mayor and council, and then they leave. But the issue, even in those interviews, even when we had 6 or 7 people covering it every day, is that the mayor typically gets interviewed, and then one of 12 members of City Council, because if you're doing a 2.5-minute news segment or a couple hundred word article, you can't cover what all 12 and 13 members have said.
Right.
And so there is this challenge of how do you branch out and connect with everyone? And it's why when I got elected in the first place in 2013, one thing I committed to doing is staying in regular communication with the people that I serve. So I don't door knock just during elections. I door knock every single month, and I've been doing that for 12 years. You know, I host regular town halls in person and online. I go to every community event I can find to try to make sure you're in front of people as much as possible. And that's and because at the end of the day, this, since local government has that greatest day-to-day impact, you want to be in front of the people as much as possible. But it's just a matter of now, especially with local media being where it's at. And our local media does a great job, but they are so under-resourced. So it's engaging with folks like yourself and so many creators to say, how do we now reach to everyone else and talk about the importance of this? And so I hope that we will actually see in this shifting media landscape an ability to try to reach more people, because now if you can put yourself out in different places, it might have a better opportunity of connecting with those folks.
Right. And it's interesting to see how social media plays a part in that. But it goes deeper than that, though, where I think it's not enough to just be on social media. It's the engagement that you're talking about, where a lot of people can stay behind the idea of social media, but it's like a double-edged sword, right? Where it's, you can play the game and make you look like you're doing all this engagement, and really you might have made 10 pieces of content in one day, and then you're just spreading it out. And it's really interesting, because I think having conversations like this really like snuffs that out, of like where the authenticity lies and how willing people are to kind of step up and engage with the community. I want to talk about closer to the learning lessons you had of going through council. You've had some defeats going into it, and then getting elected. Talk to me about some learning lessons that you've had, and what changed from the days that you didn't get elected to then you did in 2013.
Yeah, there's a few things, and I think some of it was just trying to advance my own knowledge. When I first ran, I was 23, and there are some incredible 23-year-olds, but I will say I was not maybe the best 23-year-old in the world, in the sense that I was quite arrogant back in the day. I thought I knew it all. I mean, I literally hadn't set foot in City Hall when I first decided to run in 2007. So I think that gives you a bit of a sense of the arrogance I had at that time. And so being able to learn that you don't know everything, being able to learn from your failures and appreciate maybe where your own limitations are, that's really helped. And so that's part of what played into this, is just being able to actually understand and learn that that you don't have all the answers, and that is particular when you want to serve the public. The most important thing you can do is be out in front of them and actually genuinely engaging them. So when you went from the 2007 election to the 2010, I was knocking on doors a lot earlier in 2010, but still it was only about 4 or 5 months out on that election. I had started doing prep work ahead of time. And I remember seeing the results after they came in 2010 and realized, this was it. The almost exclusive thing I still needed to do was to make sure I was knocking on doors much longer. So I actually, in 2013, I started knocking on doors a year before the election. So I was managing my retail business, and any time I wasn't at work, I was out knocking on doors. Any day off I had, I was knocking on doors. Ended up hitting about 25,000 doors. Wow. And that allowed me to connect with everyone in the ward at least once, if not multiple times. Not everyone was home, of course.
Right.
But to genuinely be able to say, I hit every door in the ward. And that was a difference maker, so that when people were finally ready to decide to vote, they had at least a connection point. They knew that I had been there. Many of them I had talked to. And especially in a world where there isn't party politics, because, you know, on the provincial and federal, a lot of us just default to the color of the team.
Yeah.
You vote for the blue or the orange or the red team. Yeah. And it doesn't matter who the elected representative is. It should, but it doesn't mean as much in the same way as locally. When we don't have parties, when it's Andrew Knack on the ballot, if you've never met Andrew Knack, why are you going to vote for that person?
Right.
Do they have a flashy website? Maybe. But if you've never met them, maybe you don't even bother voting, because you feel mm-hmm. like, what do I know about this person? They have some nice words on a website. But that's part of that lack of engagement. And so the learning is actually genuinely get out and hear people and understand. And the genuine part is important, is that what I mean by that is that it's not that you're trying to find agreement on everything. It's that you might run into somebody. I've had people that have voted for me and still have plenty of people that vote for me who don't agree with me about half the time. But the reason they still support me is because they know that we can actually have a real dialogue about the issue we're about to debate. They can share their perspective. That perspective can maybe help inform some of the decision I make, even if it's not exactly where they wanted to go. They'll know that I've been trying to find a way to incorporate some of that. And so that's the learning, is that it's just be out, connect, and broadly speaking, also remember how little you actually know. Like, it is amazing now, you know, I first ran when I was 23, I got elected when I was 29, I'm 41 now. And as the years have gone on, I have learned just how little I actually know. Mm-hmm. And it feels like every year I'm learning more and more just how little I know.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's this world that is out there that I can absorb knowledge from. And I sort of love learning how little I know, because it excites me to go and learn more.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm interested in knowing, I've asked every candidate this question of, when you're talking to some of the people, the residents door knocking, and some people have very outlandish ideas of what they think should be done or maybe it's just not a priority. What is your tactic when you have to have these conversations that are a no or a not yet? Mm-hmm. And how do you do that gracefully without, like, losing that idea?
There's a few ways. So there's sort of two examples in those conversations. I would say there's one where, you know, you run into that person who has, you know, for any number of reasons, a very different way of thinking. You know, just before I came here today to record this, I met somebody at the doors who asked me my thoughts on smart cities and mm-hmm. this idea of being in this 15-minute city. And they're worried, genuinely worried, that government is looking to lock down their movement. And they wanted to make sure that I wasn't somebody who supported that. And this is an interesting topic that came up about 2 years ago. And there are a lot of people who genuinely have such mistrust of the government that they actually think that the government is going to lock them in place and only let you go in a
like
very
15-minute cities.
15-minute city. And I think, you know, when I first, especially with this topic, when I first started hearing about it, my first reaction was just like, oh gosh, like, really? But then I realized, like, if I approach it that way with that person who's asked that question, they're not going to at all have the chance to hear a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They are caught up in the social media echo chamber and the algorithms that have said this is happening. So why not actually treat them like any other person and say, you know what, let's go through that. What are you worried about? What is the concern?
Mm-hmm.
Here's how I define a 15-minute city, and it's actually providing more choice and being able to live locally but not restricting your movement. How does that sound? And you find that at the end of those conversations, even though those folks are probably not going to vote for me, there's somebody that now had, they were taken seriously. And that's the most important.
Given a little bit of dignity.
Right? Give them dignity, give them empathy, because, you know, for a number of reasons, they've reached that point in their life. Maybe they feel burned by politicians. Maybe they've had bad life experiences. And they've reached this point where they're either believing something that might not be true, or in the case of your question, somebody who's just like almost ready for a fight. They just want to, they are not going to vote for you and they're ready to.
And it's Mary, and sometimes about this is like, it's very misguided where it's, where in your head, you're kind of like, I don't think you know what you're actually talking, but in a way where you allow them some grace and say, yeah, but I could understand. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting given the amount of experience you have, because do you think it's a skill to have to like translate political jargon or translate like where your powers are at, so it doesn't get confused of like, oh, like I'm not the guy that deals with rent caps.
Yeah.
I'm the guy that could advocate for it and advocate like the provincial government to apply rent caps. That's not really on me. Without sounding like you're being out of touch with them, right? And is that something that takes time to learn, like how I actually like give this type of language and bring it down without patronizing or sounding like I know too much?
Yeah, I would say it's something that I've developed over time, and this is again one of those things where you're working on this idea of how you talk to each person. And I think sometimes there's this perception that politicians will say different things to different people. And maybe some, I'm sure, do. But there's also politicians, people in elected office, who recognize that when you've engaged somebody, if they are coming from maybe on the right side of the political spectrum, the language and the words you might use actually just need to change in order to be able to have a genuine conversation. So when I'm chatting with somebody who's on the right side of the spectrum, because I grew up on the very right side of the spectrum, you know, I haven't hidden this part. I was very, very right wing in my life growing up, and I might not be as much anymore, but I understand that way of thinking. And so when I talk to somebody who's worried about things like housing and homelessness, and maybe they're a little less worried about the person because they think that it's a choice. While I don't believe that's true, and I think the medical evidence has proved it, I don't start the conversation by saying, well, no, you're wrong, it's not a choice. I start the conversation by saying, hey, you know, even if that's true, let's talk about the financials of this, you know, and then we go in and I cover, did you know that if we actually house somebody instead of leaving them on the street, it actually saves us money.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows them to then open up the conversation in a different way. So it is important to be able to tailor your message to each person depending on how they're approaching the topic. Now, you don't want to say two entirely different things to people on different sides of the spectrum.
Right.
But it's the words you might use, it's the how you engage in the first place. Because if I'm engaging somebody on the right about housing and homelessness, I might often talk more about the financial. If I'm engaging somebody on the left, I might talk more about the medical evidence and the data that shows if we house them, this is how it benefits. Both are true statements. It's just we're tailoring that message a bit to the audience to make sure that we can engage in that conversation and maybe bring in some of those other things they hadn't considered before.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about getting this amount of experience, it's easy to lead into the conversation of taking that step to run for mayor. And I'm curious to know what were some of the experience that you had that made it a deciding factor that you were like, okay, I want to do, because there is a level of risk involved. And it's as risky as it is, it's probably just as exciting. But how'd you weigh those options?
Yeah, it's risky, but you're right. It's very exciting because, and it's hard because there's 13 of us running and only one will be elected to serve. And so 12 folks won't be there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in terms of the decision, you know, part of this, back in September of last year, I had actually made the decision I wasn't going to run for re-election as a city councilor. And I did word my statement very carefully. I didn't actually say I wasn't going to run for re-election at all on council at all. I said just for city councilor. But, truly, I wasn't really thinking about running for mayor at that time in September of 2024. But then a lot changed in the world that started to shape my thinking a little bit differently and started to cause me to think about reaching out to others around how I can best serve. Because I still wanted to serve the public, but I felt that after 12 years as a city councilor, I didn't want to hold up space. There were incredible people who are waiting to run, and just for any number of reasons, they didn't want to run against an incumbent. It's hard. Incumbents often get reelected. And even though this opportunity to serve is truly one of the best things in my life, and there's no such thing as a bad day in this job. There can be bad moments, but never a bad day. The idea of hanging on while there were other great people, I just felt like it was time to move on. But in terms of running for mayor, how that came about is I think about what happened in the world since September of last year and the 6 months that led up to where I started to think about it differently. We had a U.S. election where we saw the re-election of someone that I don't think adds a lot to the respect and decorum of politics, and I think leaves a lot to be desired in how we handle ourselves as elected representatives. We had a federal election with a new prime minister, even though it's the same governing party. We saw the provincial government start talking about things like separation from the country, which I am not supportive of, but it took up some oxygen. Our mayor made a decision he wasn't going to run again. We also saw the introduction of local political parties, which I've been very adamantly opposed to. And that was probably one of the biggest contributing factors, is making sure that Edmontonians would still have a choice to vote for a mayor that wouldn't be part of a political party, because that system, I think, is far too toxic right now. It's far too divisive. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, no matter where you're, whether you're on the right, left, center, or like most people, probably a little bit of everywhere, that you would have a choice this election of somebody that wasn't going to be a part of that system, that would continue to strive to be independent, somebody that would work to engage as many different voices as possible. But that was a pretty big factor that caused me to start reaching out to people to see how I could best serve. And a couple months after starting to make those calls in March, I made the decision to run in May.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, because it seems like everything has kind of been building up, right? And like all the kind of pieces fell into place. Talk about the difference in running for city council as opposed for running to mayor. What are the differences? Because you guys sit on the same council, but there's different responsibilities, but there's also, it's a very different method of campaigning.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to walk through that, knowing that you have all this experience campaigning in a ward. What have you learned from this mayoral election?
Oh, goodness. So many things. It's been a journey. So, you know, your council races, if you're running for councillor, what the advice I always give people running for council is what I've talked about earlier. Knock on doors all the time. Every waking second that you have, go knock on doors. Are you tired? Go knock on doors. Are you energized? Great. Go knock on doors. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Drop what you're doing. Go knock on doors.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayoral campaign, while I'm glad I do get to knock on doors, it's impossible to knock on every door. It's not impossible if you're running for councillor. It is impossible if you're running for mayor, even if you had 4 years of nonstop door knocking, you still probably wouldn't hit every door.
Yeah.
So that means you have to find other ways to connect with as many Edmontonians as possible. But again, creating those genuine opportunities for engagement. I don't want to just show up at a barbecue, wave at everyone and then leave. How do you go and actually get to connect with people, understand where they're at? And so as in this mayoral campaign, it's been a combination of being out at the doors, hosting town halls. I mentioned, as a counselor, I hosted in-person and virtual town halls. I've tried two telephone town halls, and they were actually really effective ways to get a hold of people who maybe I haven't caught connected with before. Getting to go to many different faith communities and engage with the congregations there, or getting to engage with nonprofit communities and business communities and setting up different tables where we can bring 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 people to come talk about an issue. You know, even the telephone town hall, the last one we just did, throughout the entire night, we had at least 15,000 people join.
Wow.
And what an incredible way to connect with people who are busy with life, you know, teacher strike going on, lots of things going on, just being able to pick up your phone. Hey, that gave people an opportunity. So the mayoral campaign is different because as much as I wish it was exclusively what you would call the ground game, door knocking and delivering literature, there is a huge element of the quote unquote air war of making sure your message is getting communicated to as many people as possible to find those connection opportunities. So it's been an incredible journey. It's been exhausting because, you know, I was just before here on the very south side of the city knocking on doors. So, and then we're doing this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as we're done, I get to drive all the way back out to Southeast Edmonton for another engagement. And then as soon as that's done, which will probably be done at 8:30 or 9 at night, I'm driving back to the north side to engage people at a restaurant where we're going to bring 50 people together. And that's going to go till 11 o'clock. And then I still have emails to reply to. And so it is a whirlwind like I never would have expected, but truly exhilarating, truly inspiring, because you get to connect with so many incredible people.
What do you do when you look at like grounding yourself on a personal level? Are there any like day-to-day rituals that you have to make sure that you're bringing like your best self forward?
Ooh. This has been a hard one because normally when I, you know, when I'm looking for that downtime, even though this is a pretty time-consuming opportunity to serve, both just in the role as counselor, but also it's time consuming in the campaign. So as a city councilor, you know, I'll work 70 to 80 hours a week, but usually I set aside time to spend with family. And then, you know, late night, because I can be a bit of a night owl, I'll stay up and play some video games. That's a bit of a grounder for me. It's been challenging though, because this campaign, it's not uncommon to get up at 5 a.m. to go get home by 1 a.m. and, you know, sleep 3 to 4 hours and then you're back at it. So it's been challenging to find that balance, and because I'm trying to commit myself and make sure people know, but at the same time, stay connected with the family, friends. So, you know, my main ritual has been, you know, still truly doing like, you know, I'll do my Duolingo lesson every day still as a way of like, I want to make sure I'm still working on my French. You know, I'm still putting on a little bit of music in the car as much as I make a lot of phone calls on my hands-free while I'm driving from venue to venue. I'll still make sure that at least, you know, 15, 20 minutes I'm putting on some music that pumps me up, that keeps me energized.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to find different ways, but it is hard. The campaign is actually the hardest part because you're typically working way more than the 80 hours a week. You know, as an elected representative, even as mayor or councillor, you are probably working no more than 80 hours a week. But there's so much more to do in a campaign.
Yeah. It's kind of like you have to step it up. It's like when they look at video games when you have like a crunch time of like the last like 2 to 3 months of a game. It's like now they're in the crunch. So I kind of want to get into some of your stances with some of the things that you've talked about on your platform and, you know, talking about your blueprint of how to re-energize the downtown core, talking about police funding. But to start off, your campaign slogan is about making Edmonton affordable and safe. What's your blueprint to delivering affordability in the city where costs are rising across the board?
It's a tough question because affordability, there's so many components to this. And so it's focusing on where the city has the greatest control because, you know, at the end of the day, we don't control grocery prices or the prices of your utilities, insurance. These are ultimately things that are finalized provincially. So the city has a few roles. I mean, there are some utility things that we control, but more of it is property taxes. That's our main piece, as well as the user fees for things like transit and recreation spaces. And affordability is between that and safety. Those are the top two things I'm hearing about across the entire city from almost everyone in ways that I never heard, you know, 12 years ago or even 4 years ago. And so the way to address it is recognizing that where we have controls, are we taking action? So take housing as a really good piece. housing affordability is one of the biggest components of your overall life affordability. We know that 1 in 4 people who rent and 1 in 8 people that own are facing a housing affordability crisis where they're paying more than 30% of their income, after-tax income, to their housing costs, to their mortgage, or to the rent. And if that's what it is, then I mean, there are many people paying 50 and even 70 or 80% of their income on their housing costs. So the city has some roles to play. We all, while the city of Edmonton is considered the most affordable major city in Canada, the reason we got to that place is because about a decade ago, we started to create more opportunities for different types of housing across the entire city. And that housing choice helped make housing prices not go up as quickly as what you've seen in Toronto and Vancouver, and now even in Calgary, right? The same home in Calgary, like for like in Edmonton and Calgary. In Calgary, it's $150,000 to $200,000 more. The reason for that is that Edmonton allowed for a greater supply of housing to come onto the market. So there's a good example of how we help with affordability. Do we allow housing choice? We've continued to make changes to our zoning bylaw, which I know for people listening, don't fall asleep. Zoning bylaws really do matter because it means these are the types of houses that can be built in a community. This is where you would be able to have grocery stores or different types of amenities. And so the zoning actually allows you to have more complete communities, more housing choices, be able to live more locally. Those things contribute to affordability. If you have a house option in your price range in your community, and there is a grocery store, and there's a school, and there's a park, and there's a recreation space, now suddenly you might even be able to make a choice of saying, hey, instead of being a two-car household, what about being a one-car household? Because we can save $10,000 a year. So we're trying to expand choice for folks. Beyond that, there's the city services, and these services are going up in cost. And so we're trying to find that balance between how much do we invest in a rapidly growing city, a city that's added 200,000 people in the last 4 years, but balancing that against property taxes. Because if you go to 0% property taxes, then you're actually not funding those services. In fact, you're going to have to cut back on those services because your city's expanding. But if you go too high, like we've seen the last couple of years where we've had as high as a 9% property tax increase, then you actually run into the situation, like I've heard at many doors, where there are seniors on fixed income saying, I'm legitimately asking if I have to sell my house because I don't know if I can
get
pay
these priced out of the neighborhood.
Right. So it's finding that moderation. It's actually getting on community. It's making sure that the municipal programs we have, programs for our leisure access program and ride transit, these that give you access to recreation centers and transit. We do versions for those who are on lower incomes. And so these are all a combination of different ways that we help with affordability. The other way is, how are we creating economic opportunities? Because if we have more businesses starting up here that provide more job opportunities, that can provide somebody who's in a lower paying job with a new job opportunity that pays them more. So it's both controlling the very direct controllables like property taxes and user fees, and at the same time, a little bit more intangible about providing housing choice, employment choice, because that can also substantially help with somebody's affordability.
And when we bring on the notion of affordability, it brings in the big hot topic that you see in Edmonton, which is infill. And this is something where I've just started learning about. But how do you, if we could kind of bring it down to a surface level, what is a realistic, what is a realistic reality for people in Edmonton when we talk about infill? Because if you do too much urban sprawl, then the cost of infrastructure, bus lanes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Although some of those things get taken on from the builder and this and that, but you also look at neighborhoods that are, you know, single family homes, and then all of a sudden, boom, sixplex. So where does that balance lie? And is that in like direct relation to affordability?
100% it is, because you're right. The single biggest cost driver for property taxes in a city, especially a city like ours, is how much we are expanding. So the bigger our overall footprint becomes, that's more kilometers of roadway to plow and maintain. That's more park space to cut. That's a new fire hall that needs to be built and then staffed. Same with the recreation center, same with the library. So property taxes are driven by residential growth. So every new residential neighborhood, almost every new residential neighborhood, except one now, cost taxpayers money that we did not recover enough through property taxes to cover the cost of the infrastructure that we need, let alone the actual operational cost of it. So that plays directly into affordability, which is why 5 years ago, the city said, we're not going to annex any more land. We're going to stop annexing land. We're going to grow within the boundaries that we have. And that does still include undeveloped land at the edges.
And that's within the Hende, right?
Still, there's some outside the Hende. So for example, there's land now between 41st Avenue Southwest and the airport that can be developed. That is within the city limits, but is undeveloped at this stage. So it's not that we said we won't allow that to happen, but we said we're not going to go further beyond that because of the cost implications and also the environmental. We use up a lot of great farmland when you pave over that. So that is why we have this infill conversation. And you're right. You know, I live in a mature neighborhood myself, and I've been knocking on doors in mature neighborhoods. And what I found is that the vast majority of residents in mature neighborhoods will say, we don't want any more sprawl. And absolutely understand the reasons for infill and the benefits of infill, and are genuinely not trying to stop it. You know, I think that we're too quick to throw that term NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard, for those that don't know.
Right.
And I actually don't find the vast majority of people as NIMBYs. There's, sure, 10 or 15% of people who don't want any change.
Right.
But most say, I get that why we need to make change. But what they're feeling now is that the city's gone a little too far and we do need to scale back a bit. And so that's where I think, or at least scale back in certain areas and maybe ramp up in other areas. So the idea of, it used to be up until about a year and a half ago, the previous maximum number of units you could put on a standard 50-foot lot was 6 units, but now it's 8. And I hear from a lot of people saying, I think maybe we should go back to that 6. And to make up for it, can we do a little more, you know, on the corridor where the LRT is? Can we do a little more on that node where you're surrounded by commercial shopping spaces? And I think that's a very reasonable trade-off conversation to have. So as a city, and the way I'm approaching this is that we made a number of changes on July 8th that change how big a building can be. But those were the start of the changes that need to happen, not the end, because we do still hear from communities who are feeling very tense about what can happen, but also understand why we're going to do this and just want to see it done responsibly. And that's how I plan to do this, which is make sure we make some responsible changes, continue to provide that housing choice, because we also can't forget about everyone under 40 who is struggling with housing affordability. So if you restrict your supply entirely, then the people under 40 are going to be in an even worse situation. So let's continue to make changes, bring everyone along for this conversation, provide that affordable housing for those that are younger, while also trying to work with folks who have lived in their community for a long time who are feeling a little tense about what that development could be.
Is there measures we can put in place to allow residents in these mature neighborhoods to have more of a say or have more of a kind of being tied into the process? And what measurements would those be? Because I think at some point you can go too far and give too many people something to say, and then you can't grow anything because nobody really wants it done. But then on the other hand, you want to still reach out the olive branch and say, hey, what are your thoughts on this? So is that more of a survey type thing, or is there an actual actual rubric that could be followed to understand like the willingness?
There are different ways. So the city, like you said, there used to be a time at which even if you wanted to do an extension of your deck and it was within the rules, you still had to go get the sign off of your neighbors, even though it was completely complied with the rules.
Right.
That's an example of being too excessive, right? And so over the years, we have made changes to say, well, wait a second, if you're building within the rules, it probably doesn't make sense to give your neighbor a veto because... You know, some people might just not like change. And even though it's well within the rules, should they really be able to stop it? Should your neighbor be able to say, no, I don't want you to paint your house blue. I'll only accept it if it's green or red. And I know those sounds like a bit of a hyperbolic extreme, but that is the risk. I'm sure
that's a reality in some places.
There are some places that would be really restricted.
I'm sure based on the dynamics of some people's relationships with their neighbors, I could definitely see that.
So I think what we've tried to do over the last number of years is say, let's make sure people are engaging around what those rules are in the first place. So instead of having each neighbor being able to say, here's what I want or don't want from my next door neighbor, let's make sure we're all engaging about what are the overall rules. How big can a home be? How close can it be to the property line? Should we have parking requirements? Should we have landscaping requirements? Should we require the building to face the street in a particular way? But that is typically a better way of addressing that, because if you start getting into the granular and saying, oh, for this specific property, you need to go get a sign off on this. But again, if we've generally agreed on the overall rules, I don't think we want to get so caught up in having everyone go deal with it property by property. And so, again, this is where I think we have gone and do need to make some changes, because people are feeling like it's gone so far that because they don't have any opportunity to have a say on the lot next door, they're very concerned about the overall rules. So I think it is go back to engage people, talk about the overall rules, see where you can make adjustments and changes. And then from there, that allows that development to go in a relatively reasonable time frame. And instead of going lot by lot is really tricky, and I don't think we'll actually create the situation we want for our city that is rapidly growing. And mm-hmm. and we've seen cities like Toronto and Vancouver that were so restrictive in their zoning that what it meant is that outside of a handful of communities where you allowed any type of density, there were so many other communities that allowed no density at all. And so that's why you saw these stories of a $2 million, essentially a tear down shack mm-hmm. that's 700 square feet, because that's the only spot you can build your single family home. If you wanted to have anything higher density, you can't in that neighborhood. So your supply was restricted. So we've got to be thoughtful. We've got to react. And we do need to bring people into the conversation. It's hard with zoning though, because typically you don't get involved until something's happening next door, right?
I want to break off into talking about transit and, perceived safety when we look at transit. I'm going to pass it off to our producer, Calvin, who is our resident transit. Don't forget to unmute your mic there.
Yeah, so I have a couple questions. Some of my coworkers and some friends and all that. They want to know, have you considered expanding transit officers' powers, like criminal code authorities, warrant execution, or even EVOC level of training?
Short answer, yes. And we are actually looking into that right now, because I do think it's time. The city of Calgary does allow for that expansion of authority. And I think it's important that we have that in the city of Edmonton as well, because we know there are a lot of folks working really hard every day to try to provide that safety and security, and they feel at times they can be a little bit restricted in their ability to enforce those rules. And I always remind people, our transit peace officers are incredible, because they will engage folks with compassion first. They're not rushing to issue fines. They're not rushing to arrest. You know, when it comes to things like fare evasion, 93% of their engagements do not result in fines. Because they're looking to operate with compassion, because they're looking to be thoughtful about that. But at the same time, we have heard from a number of people who don't feel comfortable using the system that they want the transit peace officers to have that authority. And then you compare them up with social workers and others. But yes, we need to do that. I think it's time. And I know our city administration is looking into that right now.
Another transit related question here. What's next for the future of transit? Mm-hmm. Any expansion towards, you know, our neighboring cities? Are we looking to install fare gates, even in terms of safety and stuff like that?
So we'll start with the bigger picture of where next. And I think realistically, unless we see funding secured from the other orders of government, because any type of LRT expansion always has to have all three partners. I'm not sure there's going to be provincial or federal funding anytime soon for expansions. But if we could work on that, I think the next major expansion, there's going to be competing interests. I know the premier wants to do high-speed rail between Calgary and Edmonton, and I actually think that's a really great idea. I think we desperately need high-speed rail. And so there could be an argument around LRT connectivity to the airport. But I also am trying to remind folks that, you know, here in North, you know, where we're recording, Northwest Edmonton has been waiting for decades for the LRT. Castle Downs deserves the LRT. We need to get the LRT out to as close to St. Albert, if not right to St. Albert's Park and Ride. And just like we were in West Edmonton waiting for decades for the LRT, I want to make sure that every part of the city has that extension. So if we were to get provincial and federal money, I'd probably want to see it securing that expansion further northwest. And then you ask some more, you know, sort of smaller scale, like, what do we do? Do we put in fare gates? And what we saw, there was a report that we had on this that talked about if we want to try this out, it's going to cost us about $7 million to get fare gates, to try it out even just in two stations. And the data from other cities is mixed. Depending on the design of the fare gate, it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And arguably in Edmonton, what we see a lot of is it's not that there's people who are always right down at the station level. So when I'm in the downtown LRT stations, oftentimes those folks who are using the LRT is a bit of a shelter or a place where they can, use their drugs if they're dealing with addictions. They're doing it in the stairwells, well above where the platforms are. And so unless you're somehow putting a fare gate essentially at street level, I don't think that's actually going to produce the same impact. To me, what we need right now to deal with that crisis and the safety issues is we need to expand the peace officers' powers that we talked about. We need to make sure there's enough of them. We probably need at least another 60, maybe upwards of 100 transit peace officers so they can provide full coverage for the system. We do need to talk about station design. We saw this in Commonwealth, that when Commonwealth LRT station was rebuilt, it went from this dark, dingy space where you went underground and all these corners where you could hide to this street level, open space, very well lit, and crime plummeted just through the redesign of that station. So that's probably your better solution, which is that as we're reconstructing some of these stations and as we're working to try to secure funding to do some of that work, whether it's a fare gate or more just a crime prevention through environmental design approach. So I think you would want to look at that, increase the number of transit peace officers, make sure we have social workers to help those folks. And then most importantly, make sure there are permanent solutions for the folks that are struggling and using transit centers to move into. Because there's a lot of shelter beds, but there's not a lot of permanent housing for somebody to get into. And that's why I've talked about this during the campaign. I don't want to wait for the province. We've talked about this today. I want to just make sure we're taking the $91 million we're already spending and spend it in more proactive ways. And so I don't know if we'd rush to fare gates. I don't know if we should rule it out either. But at the same time, I want to make sure we're maximizing our investment on what will produce the greatest safety outcome. And fare gates isn't necessarily proven to have the greatest safety outcome the same way more peace officers would with expanded authorities.
Yeah, fair enough. I have a question about bike lanes here.
Ah, yes. The favorite conversation.
Yeah, the hot topic here. So one viewer here says, why support bike lane expansion when no one bikes half of the year due to winter? Doesn't that reduce road space and drive up taxes?
Great question. So bike lanes, I often like to start with this quick story. So I represent West Edmonton, which includes 95th Avenue in the West End. And 1 month before I first got elected in 2013, they installed a painted line bike lane on 95th Avenue, which is the road that moves about 20,000 cars a day. And I hadn't started biking at that time, but I now bike. And I'm actually one of those crazy people that bike year round. So I bike in the winter. I love biking in the winter. It's a good exercise for me. It's a good refreshing way to get about. But even as somebody that bikes year-round, almost 99% of the time, the bike lane that was built on 95th Ave a month before I got elected was a dumb bike lane. It didn't make any sense. And it understandably frustrated people. So when I got onto council, I voted to remove that bike lane and said, it's not that we should never build bike infrastructure, but we've got to be smart about it. So if we fast forward 12 years, we're actually rebuilding 95th Avenue right now. The road that was at end of life, so we're reconstructing it. And what's great about it is we're not putting in a bike lane there. But what we are doing is instead of rebuilding the sidewalk on the south side of that avenue, we're putting in a multi-use trail. And the multi-use trail and the sidewalk are the same cost. So whether you did one or the other, it's going to be the same cost. So, and here's a great example of where we're not spending any more money. It's coming out of a different bucket, if you will. The budget's coming out of a different bucket. Instead of the sidewalk bucket, it's coming out of the bike lane bucket. But we're getting a new mode of transportation. The roads are getting redone. We're not taking away lanes of traffic. And that's a great example of how you can invest. And so actually a lot of the cities, you know, when the headline came out, $100 million in bike lanes, everyone understandably was very frustrated. What I don't think the city communicated well at all is 80% of that's actually being used on multi-use trails. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that would have been money we would have spent on a sidewalk, but instead we're putting on a multi-use trail. And so I would say bike lanes on their own, without any context, just throwing them in wherever. No, that's not what we want to do. We want to be thoughtful about it. But I also do think, and this is my pitch to folks, which is that, bike usage does go down in the winter. I might use it, but I get that it goes down in the year. But if you come to the 102nd Avenue bike lane through the community of Wequentwin from 124th Street to 109th Street in the winter, you know who you see using that? You know, you'll see me. You'll see some, there are plenty of some winter cyclists, and we are growing. The numbers are growing every year. But actually, you know who you see using that I think is really matters? The seniors that live in the building on 120th Street and 102nd Avenue who are using their walkers or their wheelchairs on that bike lane. Why? Because they don't know that the sidewalks will be clear, but that bike lane is clear. And so there are seniors who can now get out to the Save-On Foods or get to the local pharmacy or get to a spot that they couldn't before. And so I do want to remind people that, you know, when we invest in this type of infrastructure, it's because we want everyone to be able to move safely. 25% of our city doesn't drive. And so just like I want to invest in the roads, and in my time on council, we've invested $4.2 billion in our roadway network. I also think it's reasonable to put some amount of money into alternative modes. That includes transit, that includes active transportation. It should still be thoughtful. We should still be context sensitive. But I don't think the numbers should be zero, because in a growing city, people deserve those opportunities. And back to affordability, transportation costs are expensive. It's $10,000 a year to own a car on average. Mm-hmm. If you can give people that choice to be a one car household instead of a two because of a different option, great. That's going to help their quality of life. So it's not that we should never invest, but we should be thoughtful in how we invest.
That's good. To wrap this up, I want to start off by saying thank you so much for coming out. This has been a very informative discussion that we were able to have. And I think we were able to answer a lot of questions that not only the residents of Edmonton, but also our viewers on this show specifically definitely had. But I want to leave it off with you and give you the opportunity to give your final message that you want Edmontonians to hear as they consider who to vote for on October 20th.
Well, thank you. And thank you again for having me. It's been a delight. I really love having these longer conversations because it genuinely does give people a chance to dig into these things in a little bit more detail. But I think my message to Edmontonians is simple. So when I started this campaign, I started by saying I'm running to build a stronger Edmonton, an Edmonton that is more safe, more affordable, and is keeping up with the population growth of our city. And at the end of the day, you might ask then, what about that though? What's next? You know, those are great words. Those are great slogans. But what does that actually mean? And to me, it means, you know, I'll take the city that we're seeing, right? Let's start with this growth piece. 200,000 people moved into Edmonton in the last 4 years. I'm actually really excited about that. Even with all of the growth challenges that creates, I start from a premise of positivity, because 200,000 people don't uproot their lives and move to a new city because they think that the city is headed in the bad direction. Now, you uproot your life and move to a new city because you see potential, you see opportunity, you see a place where you can raise a family, a place where you can get a great education, where you can get great employment, maybe start up your own company. And so I remind people about that every day to say, for the challenges that the city has, and we have challenges and we need to work on them. That's the point about making a more affordable, more safe city. We also have a lot of incredible things going on here. And I hope we celebrate that and recognize that and embrace that. And so what I want to do as mayor is to continue to invest in the people that are calling Edmonton home, to continue to invest in the city, to make sure that people have that excellent quality of life, to make sure that we're investing in ways that genuinely will make people's lives safer, that they'll make it more affordable. And so that's what I want to do as mayor. I want to take what I've been able to do as a city councilor over the last 12 years, where I've been able to help move forward things like the LRT to West Edmonton, like the new Lewis Farms Recreation Center and Library, like the back alley renewal, which sounds boring to a lot of people, except if you live in a mature neighborhood. And to take that and say, why not continue that work citywide? And to the point of our conversation that we've had today, I want to do that with Edmontonians. I want to go out into community and talk about how we accomplish these things together, how we tackle some of those challenges together, because your mayor and your councillor cannot solve every single issue. We actually need to do that as a community. So my hope to Edmontonians, and why I'm asking Edmontonians to vote for me, is, you know, I'm somebody that has a track record doing this over the last 12 years, both engaging the community, but also using that engagement to help bring tangible change. And I want to do that as their next mayor, somebody that will continue to be committed to them every day, that will find ways to help improve their lives, and that will regularly sit down with them to understand them, to the point where, like, every flyer I'm giving somebody at the door actually has my personal cell phone number on it. Why? Because I want to make sure that people don't have to chase down their mayor. I want to make sure their mayor is readily available to everyone. So that's why I'm running for mayor, to build. This is what I mean by I talk about building a stronger Edmonton. We've got a lot of great things. We have more work to do, and I know that I can do that if given the chance to serve as their next mayor.
Very well said. And here at Spare Bedroom Studios, we are wishing you all the best come October 20th. But that's been it for today on Solo Spotlight. Huge thanks to our guest, Andrew Knack, for joining us, sharing his story and vision. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Follow us on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook for full clips and highlights. Until next time, stay curious, stay kind, and stay involved.